Ladies and gentlemen, we're regrouped after our little break. And this time we're going to be hearing from Bernard Gaynor. I wasn't too sure how much reference would be made by our first speaker, Robert Balzola, about Bernard, but he's made numerous references to that. So for those who weren't sure, Robert Balzola has played a big role in Bernard Gaynor's legal disputes since his military experience in the Middle East. And no doubt he's going to tell us a lot more about that shortly. But anyhow, Bernard, he was an infantry soldier, an engineering officer and an intelligence officer in the Australian Army, and began in 1997 until 2014. He went to the Middle East on three occasions, and he came home, or awarded it over there, I guess, a rank of major. And he was awarded the United States Meritorious Service Medal for operational performances in Iraq. I used to think a major was one of those portulent fellows that got around with a walking cane and a big moustache. And I'm really surprised to see such a youthful, athletic Bernard Gaynor, to know that he's a major. Anyhow, since 2013, Bernard has been the subject of numerous legal actions, and none of these have been substantiated. He'll tell you more detail about that as we go. But all the military disciplinary administrative inquiries said he had no case to answer. But despite this, Bernard was dismissed by the Chief of the Defence Force in 2014. Bernard might tell us who that gentleman was. But, also, a gay activist in New South Wales by the name of Gary Burns has made a practice of lodging 37 complaints against Bernard. Again, Bernard will explain what that was about. Not only has he attacked Gary Burns attacked Bernard, but it's part of his life that he attacks other people who take a firm stand on anything to do with homosexuality. But Bernard's got a great story to tell us. And like I said, he's a dedicated Christian, and he's been through such that no doubt his faith has played a major part in his being with us today. So to tell us about his personal experiences in the loss of freedoms and rights, please welcome Bernard Gaynor.
Thank you very much, Ken, for that introduction. I just, before I go, I'll make sure everybody can hear me.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Ken and the Australian League of Rights, I'd like to thank you for your support and the honour of inviting me to speak today. It is a great honour, and I'm proud that this is the second time I've been able to speak to an Australian League of Rights seminar. Robert, I'd also like to thank you for your introduction. I've known you for many years now, and not only have you been a wonderful legal representative for me, but you have become a great friend, and I take great delight in your ability to impart important legal, philosophical, cultural principles to other people. You're a very well-educated person. I'm looking forward also to Michael Watson speak this afternoon. In my introduction, I was reading C.H. Douglas's three points that Ken sent through to us, and he finished the quote with this a short sentence that if we don't personally fight for our freedom, then there is no legitimate ground for hope. Now, those are C.H. Douglas's words following his exhortation to each person as an individual to take responsibility to help themselves. They are a warning to all that if we are not prepared to personally fight for freedom, then all will be lost. And of course, that is true. If freedom is not defended, if truth is not upheld, if goodness is not protected, then evil, which is a cacophony of chaos and anarchy, whose only shaping forces are hatred and malice, will prevail. The raging tempest will grow so large that all is storm and nothing can be firm footing on which any attempt at order can be made to re-establish order. Now, my speech is not as academic or as legal as Robert's. It's more personal. And the reason, one thing I want to take you to take away from this speech of a personal nature is hope. Because sometimes today, the sheer scale of insanity seems overwhelming. I know at times I'm confronted with this kind of a depression. And I think it's likely that we all are. Just reading the news, stories of madness day after day can trigger it. Sometimes it appears that the downward spiral we are in just cannot be stopped, that there is no legitimate ground for hope. Now, I want to park that sentiment with you while I tell you a story that seems, on the face of it, totally disconnected and irrelevant. Now, this story all begins at a strawberry farm not far from where I live. And at the strawberry farm, they make ice cream. There is a machine into which the attendant drops large scoops of vanilla ice cream with handfuls of frozen strawberries. And inside this machine, a kind of miracle happens. Those ingredients are delicately blended together. And then before your very eyes, a lovely strawberry flavored soft serve mixture is then funneled out into the cones that I love, waffle cones. Once a year, I take my wife and our 8 children to this farm and we pay the hefty fee of $7.50 per ice cream. And we sit in the sun on park benches next to a large strawberry field and just enjoy the moment. It really is magical and it is always enhanced by little children. Our youngest, and our youngest is only two at the moment, they always manage to cover themselves in ice cream despite their very best efforts. And they do so with beaming, smiling faces. Normally, this would drive any parent to frustration. Can't you kids even just sit there and eat ice cream without turning your entire body and the clothes over it into some kind of toxic industrial glue? Now, the answer to that, of course, is always no. Children do that. But in this particular moment, next to the strawberry field in the sun, even that is fun and innocent and lovely. And for half an hour each year, that enjoyable tradition occurs in our family. And it is wonderful regardless of whatever madness and chaos is inflicting itself on the rest of the world and is poking its nose into our life. And here we have a real mystery. It is not how to explain the existence of evil, but to explain something far greater, which is the existence of goodness in even the simplest things of life in a world filled with evil. And now I think the answer to that can be summed up this way. God exists and he is good. And I think that answer contains something deeper, which goes something like this. We were made for goodness and to be good. And even though we are clearly faced with our own internal faults and the wider problems of the world, this means that goodness is really something that is meant to be the natural state for us. As a result, it is very easy for us to fail to notice goodness, yet it is all around us. Goodness is there in every sunrise, in every flower, and in the fact that we find deep happiness when we help others and when we do the right thing. But evil is jarring. It is not natural, and so we notice it more. We focus on it more. It takes all our attention until it can seem to be overwhelming and threatens to depress us into submission. Now, all of this long introduction really sets up 3 points that I want you to ponder during the heart of my presentation today, which is all about how I have somehow managed to face up to the encroachment of an evil bureaucracy, which has done its very best to destroy my life and the life of my family with it. And without meaning to be preachy, the first point is this: God exists. Evil cannot touch him, and so we should never lose hope that goodness will prevail. The second point is this, and this is the really exciting one. When we personally get involved in the battle for freedom, which is the same thing as saying the battle for goodness, we are choosing to be part of the army that will prove victorious. So the only question that really faces us is whether we will choose to be part of that army and whether we will seize the opportunity in front of us to do something truly great. That is an exciting thought. And the third point is this: I am weak. In many ways, I'm hopeless. I tell you without a moment's hesitation that if the result of the battles I have faced, and all of us have our own battles, but if the results of this battle was really just up to me, it would have ended in disaster long ago. And I think Robert touched on this point during his speech as well. So knowing my personal weakness and the external factors such as time and money and organisation that we have faced, I'm filled with wonder at the victories that we have been able to achieve. Now, this has been done with the help of many people, in particular, Robert, who I'm extremely grateful for. We have achieved success. However, the root cause of that success is not due to me or even Robert or anybody else, but to God, who is the source of all goodness. So I'm going to tell you today about this battle and in all the ways we've been hurt in this battle. And I've thought long and hard about this because I have no doubt that those who have hurt me in this battle will watch this video. They will take joy from the fact that there's been suffering, and they will attempt to inflict this suffering on me again. Worse, they'll attempt to inflict this suffering on others because they know sometimes it succeeds and they know it will cause pain. But there is something far more important for those people, and I hope for you to understand. Despite my own fault, failings and weaknesses and the enormous pain and suffering that's been caused over the last few years, there was still victory, despite all the odds. So I can only humbly join the boast of St. Paul, who outlined all his trials and tribulations and his own personal temptations and then gloried in his weakness because it was all the more proof that God was with him. And I have no doubt that God has looked after me and my family in this battle, and our life is still wonderful and happy. And that is the greatest victory of all. Now, C.H. Douglas argued that it was the purpose of the state bureaucracy to provide us with what we need rather than to annoy and hinder us by restricting our ability to get what we need. So he wasn't saying bureaucracy was not important. He wasn't saying that it wasn't legitimate. He was just pointing out that so often it does not live up to its purpose. There are many reasons for this. You can all think of examples in the health or education or economic bureaucracies that exist to achieve a real good, but for some usually stupid reason, hinder access to health or education or prosperity. Now, the bureaucracy I'm going to talk to you about today is of an entirely different nature. It is not a necessary bureaucracy that has gone off the rails. Instead, it is a bureaucracy that has no reason for existence in the first place. And that is the fundamental reason why it is so evil. This bureaucracy only exists to pursue its own personal ends, which is to expand its power over all of society. Now, on the surface, so I'm talking about the anti-discrimination bureaucracy or industry, as I call it. And on the surface, this industry appears legitimate. It claims to protect social justice, but this is a lie. And Robert spoke about justice and various subsets of justice, but I want to say there is no such thing as social justice as put forward by the anti-discrimination industry. The anti-discrimination industry basically says that social justice is the be-all and end-all of justice. And it ignores all the other aspects of justice and the relationship between people and the payment of dues that all of us have, which is the heart of justice to each other. So its version of justice is a fragmented version of justice. And we should all know that at the end of the day, for justice to exist, it must be whole and entire, or it is not justice at all. So any organization that claims to be only for social justice is by its very nature attempting to split justice apart, which means by its very nature, it is actually for injustice. The truth is that the anti-discrimination industry is all about politics and power as ends in themselves. And it is the only industry in Australia that has the power to force its political views on you. Not even our actual political bureaucratic system does this. You can still vote for whoever you want, regardless of who is in charge. But this is not the case in the anti-discrimination industry, which is completely and entirely unelected and has the power to force you into tribunals to account not for what you have done, but for what you have thought and said, for your political views. It also usurps to itself the power to determine what can be thought and said. In other words, the anti-discrimination industry believes it has the power to determine what political views are acceptable. Now, as morality is inherently part of politics, this means that the anti-discrimination industry believes it has the power especially to determine what moral views are acceptable, and it does so as an absolute power unto itself. It refuses to accept that there is any other moral authority than itself, which means it denies God, the divine law, and even the natural law. There is only positive moral law promulgated by the high priests in the new woke temples. And this in itself is a form of madness. And I believe it is why the anti-discrimination industry spends so much of its time enforcing various other forms of madness. For example, the truly ridiculous lie that a man can become a woman. And this industry has spread like a virus. It no longer exists only in the various states and Commonwealth agencies, but has replicated itself into every workplace by codes of conduct, equity and diversity divisions and groupings, and in the HR departments. This has led to a new form of political slavery. We all know it. We all feel it wrapped around us. It is the coercive pressure that you know that you will lose your job if you are found to like the wrong Facebook page in your own private time and in your own private Facebook settings. Now, you don't need to take my word for any of this to know that this is true. Take it from Tim Wilson, who was the Freedom Commissioner at the Australian Human Rights Commission from about 2010 to 2015, give or take. This week, he admitted that human rights laws were entirely political. And I'm just going to play a short video for you where he said this.
It was within a framework of understanding that you weren't going to agree with everybody, but that's okay because, you know, I used to have these people say to me all the time, human rights shouldn't be political. And I would say, well, hang on, this doesn't make any sense. They're political ideas about political values, about political concepts implemented through political instruments, advocated by political leaders, et cetera, et cetera. Which part of that isn't political? You just think they shouldn't be political because you think that wins the argument. It's a lot of rubbish.
Yeah.
Deeply political.
Yeah.
So there you have the former Freedom Commissioner at the Human Rights Commission telling it exactly the way it is. The anti-discrimination industry is entirely political. This is from the horse's mouth. He was embedded at the very heart of Australia's anti-discrimination industry. This industry, this bureaucracy, is entirely about the pursuit of political power. But unlike politics more generally, which is also a bureaucratic system that should serve a legitimate good, this bureaucracy exists only to use the coercive power of the states to pursue the political ends of those who command this industry. It is a cancer on society, and I'm just one of many people who have felt this cancer attack me. And Robert mentioned others, John Sunol in particular. I'm just one. So let's go over these attacks. Since 2013, I have faced many, many complaints from various gay and transgender activists for my views on marriage, family, and morality. Now, my views are not strange or weird, and they are certainly not new or revolutionary. All I've done to the best of my ability is to uphold in public the teaching of the Catholic Church, which is the largest religion in the world. It is the largest religion in Australia, and it is the religion which has predominantly shaped Western civilization for the last 2,000 years. So whatever you might think about the teaching of the Catholic Church, it cannot be said that this teaching is somehow radical or that it has not been central to the way we live our lives today or to the institutions that have served our society so well for the last two millennia. These views are normal views and they should be freely expressed. But as someone who was prepared to die for this nation to protect freedom while I served in the Australian Army, it is rather shocking to find now that you can be persecuted by the organisations of our Commonwealth and the states for even daring to defend Catholic Church teachings. Now, there have been two main attacks from the anti-discrimination industry against me. The first was from within the Australian Defence Force, using the various equity and diversity policies that have been adopted by the ADF and which essentially mirror the laws and directives of the various state and Commonwealth anti-discrimination industry bodies. Now, just as backgrounds, and Ken mentioned, I served in the Army as an infantry soldier from 97. I joined full-time in 99 and served until 2012, deploying to Iraq three times. I left full-time service in 2012 for personal and family reasons, and I returned back into the Army Reserve. Now, in late 2012, the Chief of the Defence Force, Angus, Hurley, who is now our Governor General, gave approval for the ADF to march officially in uniform in a political protest against state and Commonwealth laws. It is called the Sydney Mardi Gras. And that aim, protest and political activity, is explicitly listed and embedded into its constitution. A few months later, defence personnel marched with various leftist political parties, organisations and lobby groups down Oxford Street in Sydney. At the same time, a group of defence personnel called the Defence Gay and Lesbian Information Service was campaigning the federal government to remove all rights, freedoms and fundings from Christian schools and charities. Now, the army is supposed to remain apolitical. It forbids, or it used to forbid, uniform political activity or uniformed attendance at political events. That rule has been thrown out the window. And now the Chief of the Defence Force has decided that he can choose what political events and causes the ADF supports. And this ties in, I think, very much with the concern Robert raised at the end of his presentation. You now have a politicised military that is now involved in domestic political decisions, and that is a very concerning thing. At the same time, the defence rules, which previously and correctly allowed defence personnel to engage in political activity in their private capacity and even run for office, have also been thrown out the window. A politicised military cannot tolerate private political activity that dissents from the official view. This is the real reason, the heart of the reason of why I was sacked from the Australian Army Reserve, even though the Chief of Defence Force admitted in his termination letter to me that I was a highly qualified and highly performing officer. My private views, which object to defence participation in the Mardi Gras and various agendas promoted by those who attend the Mardi Gras and by other defence officers who campaigned in their military capacity, were no longer acceptable. As the termination process unfolded, however, something truly bizarre happened. I was hit with 12 disciplinary charges for disobeying orders and commands. And these charges can carry jail sentences if you are found guilty. And I was also the subject of a high-level administrative inquiry officer inquiry, which only the Minister of Defence can authorise for public release. 7 of those 12 charges were given to my legal officer the night before the first hearing, which is a complete breach of natural justice. And I was never even permitted to see one of the complaints against me that led to the administrative inquiry. But both of these lines of investigation into me stem from complaints from gay and transgender activist officers within the Australian Defence Force. I was accused of racism, of sexism, of transphobia, and of disobeying commands. The termination process was commenced on an expectation that these administrative and criminal inquiries would find me guilty, but that did not happen. Not a single accusation against me was substantiated. Instead, it was found that there was no evidence that I disobeyed any order and that I had no case to answer in relation to the unacceptable behaviour complaints. Defence's own internal anti-discrimination processes found me not guilty. I was still sacked anyway. However, these same processes found that the transgender officer who complained against me had breached Defence's internal anti-discrimination processes by abusing my father. Defence ended up paying out $25,000 as a result of that to my father. That transgender officer was then promoted. Then he was made Queenslander of the Year. His name is Kate McGregor. It demonstrates, I think, the purely arbitrary and draconian nature of the anti-discrimination industry. It does not even care what its own legal processes determine. If it wants to punish some based on their political views, even if they are found to be innocent, and to promote others, even if they've been found guilty, it will do so anyway. There are many words that can describe such a system. The word that does it best and most accurately is evil. Now, I challenged the termination process in the federal court, as Robert mentions. At the time, I felt like I was the last man left and that I was riding my horse into the machine gun nest. I did not believe that I would be able to achieve anything at all. I just believed it was the right thing to do. However, making the decision to go to court was like stepping off a cliff. It was a decision based only on faith and hope. The initial court fees just to pay the court were $2,000. And that was about all the spare money that I had. I spent it and I prayed. And then, as Robert mentioned, I won in the federal court. I think that was a very, very important victory, even though it was subsequently overturned. The federal court found that the termination decision breached the implied constitutional freedom of political communication. The chief of the defence force, it found, could not sack an officer for expressing his private political views in his own private time. Unfortunately, defence appealed and the full court of the federal court overturned that decision. And the High Court refused to grant me permission for special leave to appeal. Now, defence spent $750,000 to achieve this outcome. It has since spent at least another $50,000 more pursuing me for costs, knowing full well that it will only ever be able to recover a tiny fraction of even that $50,000, if it can even recover anything at all. Basically, I have nothing left. Now, this in itself is a gross abuse of taxpayer funds, which defence is supposed to protect. It's entitled to pursue costs, but not when doing so is going to cost the taxpayer more than they will ever recover. No doubt, this attack on me from within defence has all the hallmarks of defeat. And in many ways, there have been very practical defeats. The bad guys were promoted. Defence secured the power to promote certain political agendas and to sack those who expressed different views, even though they're lawful, privately. And I lost my job. And enormous public money was spent to achieve all of this. But at the end of the day, I believe that the cost to defence to do all of this has been far higher. Defence has proven that the anti-discrimination industry will abandon all principle and ignore the finding of its own processes to impose its will. And this proves that this industry is entirely arbitrary. Defence has achieved victory by selling everything for clear hypocrisy, chaos, and whim. The price of that victory cannot be sustained. One day it will be overturned. I don't know when, and I don't know by who. It'll be someone with courage, but it will happen. My biggest fear is that the price has not yet been paid in full, because there are consequences for practical outcomes that are bad for society. When militaries abandon logic and morality, people tend to die. All Australians should hope that this will not be the price our nation pays, either at the hands of a politicised defence force or at the hands of an aggressor that our now insanely politically correct defence force may one day need to confront. The second attack I've faced is from a gay activist and self-described anti-free speech activist in Sydney, Gary Burns. Since 2014, Burns has lodged 37 anti-discrimination complaints against me under the New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Act. Again, not a single complaint has been substantiated, despite the fact that these complaints have been brought before the New South Wales Civil and Administrative Tribunal, the Tribunal's Appeal Panel, the local court, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeal, and even the High Court of Australia. In fact, in this process, the only people who have been found to have breached any laws in this long saga are those who worked in the anti-discrimination industry. The High Court found that the tribunal had no powers and was breaching the Constitution to even hear the complaints against me. And the president of the Anti-Discrimination Board has been forced to admit in writing to me that she failed to comply with her own requirements under the law. Burns himself is now bankrupt as a result of his defeat in the High Court. He has also been found to have committed acts that constitute contempt of the very system he complains to. In every way, this farce has been an unmitigated disaster for the entire anti-discrimination industry. Yet it still continues, and I'll go through the current situation a bit later. And the lengths it has gone to continue this disaster really are unfathomable. Burns has boasted that he was lodging complaints to bankrupt me. The board in New South Wales knows this because I've sent the board the emails where he stated that this is his intention. And the board has then gone ahead and removed that material from my compilation of evidence, describing it as irrelevant when it has referred Burns' complaints to the tribunal. So the board is hiding evidence. It knows and proves that Burns is a vexatious complainant. And even though the board marches in the Mardi Gras, while investigating my views of the Mardi Gras, it denies that it is biased. At the tribunal, I've sat before a magistrate who has campaigned to fundraise for an LGBT activist legal organisation. That same magistrate has been forced to recuse herself after evidence was presented in a different matter that she had held private conversations with Gary Burns. That magistrate had previously overwhelmingly decided in Burns' favour, and she made two decisions against me while she was sitting on matters involving Burns. I was threatened with contempt of court charges by the New South Wales Crown Solicitor's Office just for writing about the conduct of the magistrate. I told them to fill their boots and they backed down. I've appeared before a judge whose tip staff, his assistant, was a gay activist who the day before a hearing offered Burns a further opportunity to put on new submissions. I've had the New South Wales Police Gay and Lesbian Liaison Officers tell me that they would take no action against Burns for his threatening emails, threatening my family's safety, because they were free speech. Yet despite all of this institutional bias against me, the 37 complaints, the threats, the intimidation, the cost of it all, not a single complaint against me has been substantiated. It really is incredible. In one way, it highlights the sheer incompetence and cowardice of it all. Any other kangaroo court regime would have stomached up the courage by now just to declare me guilty. The anti-discrimination industry here in Australia, for all its threats and its power and its state resources, still does not even have the courage to do that. However, the process continues, and this is the current situation. Burns is bankrupt, but this has not changed much yet at all. He went bankrupt back in July. Over the past few days, the official trustee in bankruptcy has written that he does not intend to take any action to stop Burns' litigation. The New South Wales Local Court also seems to have no interest in the fact that Burns is now bankrupt. So I'm currently in the process of obtaining legal advice as to whether to challenge the trustee's ruling, including whether the trustee could be held liable for any costs I incur in the future as a result of this decision. Regardless, Burns does face a security for cost motion in the New South Wales Local Court, which has not yet been determined. I'm also in the process of examining Gary Burns' finances because, and he had until the end of August to provide his financial details, which he has not done so. This does not surprise me at all. And I don't want to say too much more about this, but whatever happens from here on in, I think this particular aspect of all these matters will become the most important and it will have the most fireworks. Burns, I'm sure, is desperate to avoid this process. I have good reasons to believe this, although I will not divulge them now. So I'm currently in the process of obtaining court orders to enforce this financial examination, and I'm confident it will be achieved. The New South Wales Parliament just yesterday handed down its report into Mark Latham's proposed bill to force the New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Board to end vexatious complaints. In some ways, this report was disappointing. It rejected Mark's bill. It makes it clear that the Greens, Andrew Shoebridge, and leftist members of the Liberal Party and the Labor Party have decided to ignore the issues that were raised during the inquiry. Again, I'm not surprised that this occurred. The inquiry did not want to hear from me. It suppressed much of my submission. It did not call me as a witness. It is akin to holding an inquiry into the bushfires earlier this year, but deciding that no evidence about any specific fire would be published or discussed. It's also disappointing that supposedly conservative Liberal Party members would side with the Greens. However, this report is important and it is a victory. It has at least raised issues that will prove fruitful in the future, with the committee chair, Robert Borsak, writing that in his view, there are individuals misusing the complaint process for personal vendettas. And in doing so, wasting taxpayers' resources unnecessarily. I would like to take this opportunity, especially to thank Mark Latham for his efforts in putting forward this bill and raising this issue in Parliament. Now, I can't vote for Mark. I don't even live in New South Wales, yet he still stood up for me, my family, and for what was right. And I'll forever be grateful to him for that. And I'm sure that his efforts will succeed in protecting Australians. But win, lose, or draw, he has helped me. And as I said, I'll forever be grateful for that. So God bless Mark Latham. The New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Board has just recently dismissed Burns' 37th complaint against me. But the reason for this dismissal was rather frustrating. It was not dismissed for any proper reason, such that it was vexatious. or that Burns was using it to try and get out of his bankruptcy, and I presented that evidence to the board. Instead, it was dismissed because Burns chose to withdraw it. Now, I presented other evidence to the board, which I believe Burns simply did not want to face, and so that's why he withdrew this complaint. The board needs to consider this evidence and it cannot ignore it. I believe it needs to refer this evidence to another state government department for action. Within the New South Wales Civil Administrative Tribunal is probably the most bizarre situation that is going on at the moment. It remains reserved in relation to an appeal I lodged earlier this year in relation to a 2018 decision by the tribunal to decline to determine Burns' complaints so that he could bring them to the local court. I lodged this appeal following the Court of Appeal ruling against me earlier this year for numerous reasons, including the fact that when the tribunal made that 2018 decision, it was actually stayed by the High Court, or as a result of the High Court hearing, and had no power to make any decision at all. Now, to be honest, this entire situation is extremely bizarre and I don't really know what will happen. On the one hand, the High Court has ruled that the tribunal has no powers at all over these matters. And on the other, after that decision was made, the New South Wales Court of Appeal ruled that the new law that allows the tribunal to receive complaints, even though the High Court ruled that it could not, was valid. That law is also valid, even though it allows the tribunal to make decisions and to even hear appeals to those decisions. Now, frankly, I don't think any of that makes sense, but it is the current state of the law in New South Wales. And again, on one hand, I've been told by a judge of the Court of Appeal that I need do nothing in the tribunal because I don't live in New South Wales. And again, on the other, the same Court of Appeal has just ruled that the tribunal can impose cost orders against interstate residents. So I can hardly afford to do nothing if doing nothing means that cost orders may be awarded against me. It is all very confusing. And I don't think anyone really knows what it means, except that this is a major concern of the legal system, even as the world is in the midst of a supposed pandemic. And I think that says a lot about both our legal system and the pandemic today. My view is that if the tribunal has no power, then any law passed in New South Wales Parliament pretending to give it power is invalid, which means that complaints cannot even be commenced in the tribunal. Logically, that should also mean that I can't bring appeals to the tribunal, but it would mean that the tribunal would have to dismiss the complaints as well because they could never be sent there in the first place. But who knows what will happen? I'm in New South Wales local court as well. Burns' four remaining complaints against me are there. These matters are currently stayed because of the appeal in the tribunal. That's a statutory stay. They're also stayed pending an appeal I've lodged in the High Court to the New South Wales laws. But they are not stayed because Burns is bankrupt. That issue does not seem to matter at all. And even though the matter is stayed, the court is still accepting documents from Burns. He seems to lodge a new affidavit at whim every second week, and that's all fine and dandy. And the local court still has not yet heard my motion for security for costs against Burns. I remain confident that it cannot be ignored. And the High Court of Australia is currently processing my application for special leave against the Court of Appeal's decision that the new New South Wales laws allowing the tribunal to receive Burns' complaints are valid. There are a number of processes to go through in relation to this application, which Robert and I are currently working through. And again, the New South Wales Attorney General is opposing me in that matter. Now, all up, as I have to keep emphasising, 37 complaints, litigation in every court in New South Wales, most federal courts, the High Courts, intervention by Attorney Generals from across the Commonwealth, 12 military charges and inquiry, officer inquiry. And there are really only two things to say. Not a single complaint against me has succeeded. All of this also has probably cost the taxpayer in excess of $5 million. And I'll go through some of those figures in a minute. And somehow the leftist members of Parliament think that the anti-discrimination system is working fine. They are crazy, and as a result, they are willing to inflict pain. And I'll go through some of the costs. The complaint process within the anti-discrimination industry is a gravy train for activists. It always punishes the defendant, regardless of the outcome. It is free to lodge complaints. There is no penalty for false or vexatious complaints, nor is there any requirement to dismiss such complaints. Complaints are generally heard in no-cost jurisdictions, which means that the defendant will always suffer financially if they decide not to hand over the extortion, go-away money and defend themselves. Now, defending myself has been expensive. It has cost over $500,000. Over $500,000 in legal costs have now been paid. About 20% of that, fortunately, has come from costs recovered against the New South Wales Attorney General and the State of New South Wales, but that is a lot of money. And I just want to make a few points about money because it can be taken the wrong way sometimes. We need to pay proper wages to our legal representatives in justice. We also need to pay legal representatives appropriately so that we can have more Roberts, we can have more Peter Kings, we can have more good solicitors and barristers representing Australians in the courts. If we don't pay them, they won't be there, and that will hurt all of us. And I need to thank the many, many people who have assisted, including some who are listening today. There have been thousands who have donated. And I also just want to point out that while I've spent $500,000, the Defence Force spent $750,000 in just three matters. I've spent $500,000 in approximately 50 separate complaints. I've had one legal expert tell me that the two-day High Court hearing in which every state's Attorney General showed up back at the end of 2017, except South Australia and the Commonwealth Attorney General, would have cost the taxpayer of the states and the Commonwealth over $1 million just for that two-day hearing. That does not include all the legal work that went on before that from all the Attorney Generals, does not include the matter in the Court of Appeal, does not include, well, there were three matters in the Court of Appeal, two in the Supreme Court. It does not include any of those matters. So that's why I believe over $5 million has been spent easily. And I think that we're achieving very good victories at a fraction of that cost. But that cost is also not the only cost. In 2017, my wife and I had to sell our house. We basically have no assets left. In 2015, we had to move our house because Gary Burns obtained my address from the electoral roll and began communicating with Islamic organisations. That caused a huge amount of stress. It definitely affected my wife a great deal. She was very concerned for our family's safety. And that stress has been incredible. There have been stress over the possibility that a loss in this matter could mean that I would potentially face contempt of court if I ever spoke about issues in relation to marriage or morality again, which carries with it an implied threat even of jail. It's manifested itself in loss of sleep, loss of enjoyment of life. It's affected the relationship with my wife at times and with my children. It's brought dissension and anger into our family. At times, it has led to a kind of lethargy or apathy where I felt like I've just been stuck in the mud and unable to do anything at all. It has led to anger. And all of this has had a big impact on family happiness and well-being, an impact on me, an impact on my wife, on our children. Of course, the mere accusation of an anti-discrimination complaint brings it with a loss of reputation. And I can absolutely guarantee that there has been a loss of friendship, especially with some of my former colleagues in the Australian Defence Force, who are now approaching the time in their career where being politically correct is especially important if you wish to continue and have a successful career. All of these sufferings have been real. They have been felt. But all they do is add to the incredible fact that in spite of all these sufferings, in spite of all the financial, organisational, time constraints that I've faced, victory has been achieved over the anti-discrimination industry. So like St. Paul, I can take glory in these sufferings and my own weakness especially, because that is proof of the goodness of God. And as Robert said, providence provides when you do all you can to help yourself. And I believe victory has been achieved in the other following ways as well. We defeated their complaints. We built an army. As I said, thousands have supported. And we're now funding defences, I can say, for additional persons who are suffering under the anti-discrimination industry. There has been a refusal to cower before the face of the anti-discrimination industry. And there is an ability to smile and even thank God. And I think that last victory is the most important one of them all. It is recognition of God and goodness and all that comes with it, especially hope. And I think this victory is the one that most infuriates our enemies of all of them. I suspect they cannot stand the fact that I can sit here after all these years and not only thank God, but even thank him for what I've been through. And I do thank him for that, not to infuriate our enemies, but because through these sufferings, he has given me an opportunity to do good. I only regret that at times I've not done it more perfectly or willingly. And Ken, I'll hand back over to you.
Yeah, I did say you could have 5 minutes at Bernard, but never mind. Yeah, you've done very well. Now, we're looking to get some questions, and I think people are not finding it too easy in the chat room. I might even just quickly ask Arnie Lukes, who's the pilot running this whole show. Do you have any evidence of questions at your side there, Arnie?
Okay, I should be coming through, Ken.
Yes.
It's actually a question from Lou Cook.
Oh.
The government legislates law and then appoints a zealot to oversee the application of these laws, who then set out justifying their existence. This is a witness of, if you like, the Human Rights Commission. And that in itself, I think, is an important one for Bernard to consider, at least his life experiences in.
Yeah, well, Arnie and Ken, I can just comment on that. I think that one of the significant problems with the anti-discrimination industry is that it is, to use an army phrase, a self-licking ice cream. So it justifies itself by creating an environment where there are more and more complaints about more and more ridiculous things. They like complaints. They like vexatious complaints because it gives them a reason to exist.
Hmm.
There's no doubt about that.
Is in one I wrote myself. I've recently read a book written by W.V. Evatt, who was actually a Labor politician. He was originally an industrial lawyer who was appointed to the High Court after a short stay in New South Wales. Lower house, appointed to the High Court for 10 years, and then he moved into an Attorney General position for the Labor Party, and at one stage he even led the party. I have to qualify that because it's an important book in that he concentrates on the reserve powers of the Crown, and I think that to me in his book he says that liberalism is as likely to side with socialism as to side with conservatism. And now you talk about the left of the conservatives as doing this and that. And I just wonder, is there a vacuum? Is there a lack of genuine conservatism within our parliaments in light of, say, Corey Bernardi establishing the Australian Conservatives, but calling it liberal democracy, which to me is a confusion of words, of descriptors?
Yeah, Arnie, I think there is definitely a vacuum of real conservatives in parliaments. I do have to say that I believe that is our fault, not the fault of our enemies. For probably a generation at least, conservatives simply didn't bother showing up. And if you don't show up, you're not going to win. There's no doubt about that. And I'd also just add the comment that liberalism is not as likely to side with socialism as with conservatism. I'd say it is far more likely to side with socialism than conservatism. In fact, it's inevitable that it will do so because liberalism itself, when it goes to, you take it to the end of that philosophy, results in a kind of individual anarchy. And in that environment, we always turn to the same old rule, which is might is right. That's where liberalism leads.
But the I think where Bernard has taken us is very, very important, that the lack of genuine conservatism in the, if you like, the Liberal Party. And I note that it's a coalition there. And I've seen so many times that the National Party, if you like, originally representing farmers, was always big on the get big or get out, which of course to me is the extension of liberalism. It's a continuation of the von Mises type of point of view about monopoly capitalism. in favour of it, get big or get out. So to me, they, considering that the National Party or former Country Party is there as part of the problem, the Liberal Party is there as part of the problem. To me, the, if you like, the opportunity is for, is for people to think about what they're actually going to do. Now, in Victoria, they've got a council election coming up in about a month. And I noticed that the candidate closing was yesterday, if I've read the schedule right. The fact is, Victoria can do something almost immediately, heading towards the council, and then from there, increase the groundswell, if you like, the groundswell. My thoughts are that the reading Evatt's book is the critical importance of the state's house, the upper house in the state level, and also the federal level. These to me are untapped resources that are there, and we're actually, we're really lacking in our understanding of civics and the actual working of our parliaments and our government functionaries. Your thoughts, please, Bernard.
Look, I think on the Liberal Party point, I've come to a conclusion after many years of trying to work in minor parties that as a practical vehicle, Conservatives, and most of them, or many of them probably don't want to hear this, need to get involved inside the Liberal Party. That's my view, because that is the most practical vehicle to achieving a good anywhere in politics, of getting people elected to Parliament. And yeah, absolutely, we need to get people elected into the upper house who are willing to do the right thing. I've been very lucky to have Mark Latham in New South Wales. Without his support and efforts in New South Wales Parliament, and he is One Nation, so he probably would disagree with me on my view about the Liberal Party, but he's done a fantastic job, and I'm very grateful that he's there. And also, I just wanted to mention that there are some questions in the actual Q&A chat, which I don't know answered.
Yeah, I've just been looking there too. Steve Lloyd said he sent a question. Can you see this one, Arnie? So we'll have to read that one out. I think we've... Arnie's talked about the King and the Dominion. Lou Cook had his answered.
I've got a couple here. I've got
right, yeah, way you go, Arnie. You do it.
Can you be more specific about the army that has been built up to push back against the discrimination industry?
Okay. Look, what I was alluding to in that comments was actually what Robert spoke about earlier today. So I'm very glad Robert spoke about that, and I'm very proud and honoured to be working with Robert and others on that. It's still very early days. But I just know from my personal experience, there are thousands of Australians out there who are good people. They are conservative people. I think that they need leadership, because a lot of people can see the problems. They just don't know what practical steps they can take to deal with those problems, to fight back. And I think they're calling, looking for leadership. And when it's provided, and I hope that I can be part of that, I think we can build something formidable. There are thousands of people out there, and I think you've got enormous capacity for fundraising, for lobbying, for political campaigns. It's just got to be properly developed and led. And I think we've seen some efforts in the past, which for various reasons just haven't worked. And I you know, my efforts in minor political parties, I would say, is one of those failed efforts. I would say the Australian Conservatives was a completely failed effort. Conservatives have to start using their brains, organising properly if they want to win.
Aren't all the courts now commercial, as is in the army, etc., thus the key problem? Do they have a vested interest in the outcome?
Well, I don't know they're commercial in the sense that they're a business, like a free enterprise business, but they certainly are little empires, and little empires that have secure taxpayer funding. And you know, there's a lot to be said about the series of Yes Minister, Yes Prime Minister, that one of the reasons it's so funny is because it's true. And as Sir Humphrey pointed out, in that it is the goal of every bureaucracy to increase its budget and to increase its power. So I think there is a bit of an attitude like that that exists in the court and the army and across state bureaucracies. And of course, that attitude is contrary to the goals of a bureaucracy, which is to provide us what we need rather than to hinder us in our ability to get what we need.
Yeah. No, that's really important. In regard to, and this is out of left field, but it's certainly the principle is there, the Murray-Darling Basin plan and the authority that goes with it. I note that they took a review, if you like, of their structure. I was involved in some interviews earlier on this year. And the big issue I got, the big ticket out of it, was that if only they had more power, if only they had more power, they'd be able to actually manage this thing. And yet it never actually came down to a question of, why don't we just put some more water down the Murray-Darling? And then everyone will get enough, there'll be a sufficiency of it, and they will have provided, and we don't even need to exist. It seems as if the answer of their very existence is self-serving, rather than actually looking at a solution to the problem so that you don't need the bureaucracy that's behind it. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't want to comment too much on the Murray-Darling water issues, because that is something that I have very little knowledge or understanding of. But I do make the points, I talk about the issue of power. Yeah, and I think you'll find every bureaucracy will say that one of the key solutions they need to their problems is more power. And it's interesting, when I was writing my speech, if you look at one of the problems with the anti-discrimination industry is that it has actually decentralized in many ways. It's consistent, that there's like a centralized thought process, but its power has come because it's decentralized by replicating itself into government departments, big business, and even small and medium businesses now through HR departments and things like that, which is kind of a principle of handing control to the lowest common level, which is something I support. But that's one of the reasons why the anti-discrimination industry has been able to obtain such power, because it's adopted that approach. And it's not good that they've obtained that power, but it points to the effectiveness of decentralized decision-making and control, which is something I think is quite often lost.
Okay, I want you to just ponder a thought here, because to me you've touched on a raw nerve. And the thought is this, that implementing or managing a centralist policy remotely, right? Now, for instance, we've got these COVID marshals. They're implementing a lockdown policy locally, but the policy is still about centralizing power. So I think we need to identify the difference between something that allows people to walk about freely, express their views freely, and exercise their entitlements freely without interference. And the other one is imposing that power locally. So you've got this, if you like, many, many dictators floating everywhere. And I think that to me is if you like, an extension through things like HR, things like job security and all this sort of stuff. It's an imposition of a centralist policy. You will speak this way, you will treat these things in this fashion. And if not, of course, you're jeopardizing your employment future prospects.
Yeah, absolutely, Arnie. I forgotten exactly what you said at the start, but what's happening in Victoria, I just did a video yesterday. I said it's like a massive replication of the Stanford experiments, where they got 12 university students and had them act as guards, and they got 12 university students and had them act as prisoners, and they tested the impact that had on their relationship and their behavior. And we're replicating that across a state right now. And we're going to see exactly the same results in the Stanford experiment, which is those who've been given arbitrary power over others for no specific purpose or good reason at all are going to start exercising that power in pretty brutal ways. And we don't want to see that.